Hello, welcome to Choose Wisely. This is the podcast where we deconstruct food and sustainability topics with nuance and primary sources. At Choose Wisely, we believe there are a lot of right ways to eat well and be sustainable, and that we can't change a food system we don't truly understand. I'm your host, Caroline Nelson, and today's episode came out of this burning question that I've had for years. So we all know that cattle can be grass-fed or grain-fed, right? And when we think of grass-fed, we think of grazing in a pasture or maybe cows that are eating grass in the form of baled hay. When we think of grain-fed, we think of the cereal grains. We probably think of feedlots. We think of barley, wheat, oats, maybe also corn. Maybe we also think of soy, but I'd like to point out soy is technically a legume. But yeah, that's how our brains divide these categories, neat and tidy, grass or grain fed. Well, early on in my ranching journey, I learned something that really confused me. Grains are grasses. What? Yeah, so barley, wheat, oats, corn, they're all grasses. They're all grass plants. The grains for which they get their colloquial name, the grains are simply their seeds. Grasses of all types go to seed in the fall. They get seed heads on them. And here's where my brain really started to melt. Because if that grass goes to seed and it's in a pasture and a steer comes along and grazes it off, why would that be considered grass-fed? But if you harvest that same seed head, dry it out a little, and then feed it to them, it's considered a grain, and now that steer is grain fed. I just could not make this make sense. And it didn't really matter for us. We're happy to use the terms the way they are understood in the mainstream, but my analytical brain just didn't like this. It felt like the delineation was arbitrary and sloppy. And I knew I wanted to talk to a plant scientist to help untangle this for me, because I love to bring this up at conferences. I love to see what people have to say about this. And I've just never gotten a satisfactory answer. And so when Professor Steve Smith and I were emailing prior to this interview, I brought this question up and he basically said, I don't like the term grass-fed at all. And I wish we could just get rid of it. And that's when I knew we had to chat. So Steve, who, as I mentioned, he's a professor and a PhD, but he prefers to go by Steve. He was recommended to me by one of his students. And so on this episode, we're going to talk about all kinds of things. We're going to get into the grass-fed versus grain-fed debate at the end. But first, we're going to talk about what makes grasslands such special and also fragile ecosystems. We are surrounded by grasslands in the US, yet it's kind of an invisible ecosystem. We're going to talk about the role of large ruminants, cattle, it used to be bison, now it's cattle, on these landscapes, and why grazing is such a Goldilocks situation where it's always about just right, you know, grazing just the right amount, just the right duration, and, you know, how and why so much of our rangelands have ended up overgrazed. We're going to discuss how grasslands and grazing animals co-evolved together, but how, you know, today, how we're using the landscapes is very different from the pre-colonization era. And we'll talk a little bit about how cattle differ from bison that once roamed this land and what might be coming down the pike in terms of some new technology that could radically improve our grazing practices here in the US. And then at the end, I'm going to ask Steve on his opinion of GMOs. But before we get started, we have been busy over on the Patreon. We just put up a Patreon-exclusive episode. This one was a personal one for me. It's about navigating a crunchy-adjacent pregnancy, which is what I'm calling sort of my path through the medical system and through all things while being pregnant. And we also just put the extended version of our latest episode with Dr. Mintliner, the one called Are Cow Burps Causing Climate Change? So that full episode is also up on the Patreon. I want to thank our new regenerators. These are the folks who have signed on to support us as an independent podcast who believe in what we're doing and really help me put all this out. This takes a lot of time and some expense, and I love doing it, and I couldn't do it without you guys. So thank you to Brooke and Claire, Phaedra, Brianne, Annika, Amy Lynn, Lonnie, Mindy, Florence, Sarah, Abby, and Emma, and welcome. Steve Smith is an associate professor in the School of Renewable Natural Resources and the Environment at the University of Arizona, where he has been on the faculty since 1984. He grew up in the Central Valley of California, where he first began working with plants under the supervision of his father, a commercial plant breeder. After receiving a BS in plant sciences from the University of California, Davis, he received an MS and PhD degrees from Cornell University in plant breeding and botany. Dr. Smith teaches undergraduate courses in biology, field botany, and sustainability. So let's welcome Steve Smith. Choose Wisely is brought to you by Little Creek Lamb and Beef, which happens to be our small business. My husband Justin and I raise dry-aged beef and grass-fed lamb, and we ship it all over the country from our ranch to your doorstep. We just launched our holiday shop, and it's full of festive beef bundles for everyone on your list, from the steak lovers to the grillers to the busy families. Simply choose your holiday bundle, select your shipping date at checkout, leave a gift note, and we'll take it from there. These bundles are perfect for family, friends, employees, co-workers, and anyone you want to wow or send a little love to. Visit littlecreekmontana.com to shop and use code WISELY, W-I-S-E-L-Y, in all caps, that's code WISELY, for 10% off your first order. Steve, thank you so much for coming on Choose Wisely. I have been joking with some friends that I'm moving from my kind of animal or livestock era to my plant era, and I'm just so excited to have you on to talk all things grasslands and sort of the origin of the base of like all these trophic levels that we love to talk about on the podcast. You are a specialist on rangelands. You're down in Arizona. Would you kick off by telling us what is ecologically unique about rangelands? I think a lot of people sometimes think of them as like the big empty. You look out and it just, oh, this is a desert, or this is, you know, not much is going on out here.
Yeah. I mean, for many people, it is that flyover environment. But interestingly, rangelands are really difficult to define. And at least in North America, it really depends on where you are. So where you are, grasslands primarily. South and west of you are huge areas of the Great Basin that are rangelands, that are shrublands, shrub-dominated, less dominated by grasses. Mm-hmm. Go farther west, you get rangelands in California that are really woodlands with scattered oak trees, but grasses as a major understory component. And then you come farther south and a little bit east to where I am now. And really, we're looking at mostly deserts as what rangelands really represent. If you go to the textbook, it'll say roughly 40% of the Earth's land area could be considered rangeland. So that's huge areas of Africa, huge, huge areas of Southwest and Central Asia, Southern South America, Australia. Even in many people's view, Northern Scandinavia and Northern Europe, where Sami and reindeer herders are sort of the common users of rangelands. But usually scientists such as myself describe them in a particular way, that they have native vegetation present, and that native vegetation may actually be dominant on the site. Most importantly, probably they're too dry, or too cold, or too hot, or too rough for traditional crop production or for traditional forestry. So that's sort of how you define them. And I think as we talk, a lot of the things that I say will be influenced by where I've spent the last 39 years, which is in a desert rangeland environment here in southern Arizona. A major common factor in virtually all rangelands will be the presence of some animals that are grazing at least at some period of the time. And they may be originally wild, and now domestic animals. When I teach grazing ecology and management here, I like to say it's ants to elephants. Mm. So some of those animals are very, very small and some are quite large. And most livestock obviously fit in that latter category. So one of the products that rangelands are well known to produce will be livestock products and also traction from livestock. So essentially livestock pulling a wagon or a plow, that's traction. But there are other services that they provide. And water is certainly one that I think a lot about in our part of the world. There are places where carbon is stored. Mostly that's in the soil. It's not in the plants. There are places that in many areas of the world, especially in North America, they're valued because they provide open space and recreation. And finally, we see in many areas of the world, minerals and fossil fuels come from rangeland environments. Mm. If you ask me, as you did, I think they're special because they're lonely and they're quiet and they're vast and there simply aren't many people there. That, for me, is one of the real lures for rangelands. What that means is that, especially in North America, we often treat them as wastelands.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a problem.
In some ways, I think of grasslands, we sort of define them in terms of what they're not. They're kind of an overlooked ecosystem, in my opinion. I didn't know this, that grasslands are so threatened globally. Is it true that... I think I've read they're the most threatened ecosystem.
Yeah, that's true worldwide. In North America, the threats for replacement. Mm-hmm. So let's take a grassland environment in the central part of the United States. The threats for replacement are relatively low right now. You know, there's a little bit of conversion of grassland to cropland going on. But in other areas of the world, especially in Eurasia, there's a lot more of that going on. And in South America, actually.
And you mentioned that there's a lot of carbon storage in the soil. And I think that's one of my favorite things about grasslands. They play this kind of invisible ecological role when they're functioning well. They're also very brittle in the sense that when things start to go wrong, overgrazing, things like that, they can unravel very quickly. And I'm just speaking about, we're in kind of in the high desert up here. Uh-huh. Very, very brittle landscapes. So I'm excited to give our listeners a hint into their wonder today and why we need to give a shit about our grasslands. I've already mentioned a few of the things that are threatening them. I've heard accounts of, you know, in the days of colonization, that we had like meters of topsoil in some of our richer grasslands in the center of the country. So conversion to cropland threatens grasslands. That's one thing. Also, overgrazing, as I mentioned, and we'll come back to that. But I wanted to ask you about invasive species, because this is something we see a lot out here. We have cheatgrass. We have, I mean, almost everything you look around, there's like just point randomly and there's invasive species. So what's the state of our grasslands in terms of the invasives?
I think our understanding of the effects of invasive species on rangeland health is pretty good. We know what they're doing. The bigger challenge in all rangeland invasive plant problems is that solutions are really difficult. Even if those solutions involve slowing down the invasion, they're called invasive because they have the ability to move quickly. And also, they're going to cause some problem to ecological function or to human health. Options for eradication, other than on really small scale, there just aren't many. With rangeland weeds especially, or rangeland invasive species especially. And it's ultimately tied up in how valuable these lands are, and they're not relative to cropland and other environments. And so we can't spend a lot of resources, even if we had solutions. Mm-hmm. There's, I will say, a lot of really interesting science being thrown at some invasive species problems, and I'm talking invasive plants, quite a bit of effort going on in sort of the heart of the Great Basin, dealing with pathogens, disease organisms that will preferentially attack brome grasses.
Hmm.
That's the genus that cheatgrass is in. And I think, you know, within a generation, there may be some hope that we could use a true biological control to affect cheatgrass populations. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, with cheatgrass and with a lot of invasive species on rangeland, we're trying to minimize the damage, but we're also doing something that even 20 years ago was quite unusual with invasive rangeland plants. And that's trying to do interdiction, trying to keep species that we know are going to be problematic from getting introduced initially, or when they are, stomping on them really quickly so that they don't take off. There are people doing targeted grazing. In some cases, this is where animals, frankly, often goats, are used at very, very high stocking densities for very short periods of time at just the right time
right.
of the
like
year.
Early cheatgrass, like May, yep. you know, yep. it's still palatable.
Yep. And trying to reduce the ability of that cheatgrass to produce seed. It's actually not terribly useful. Targeted grazing like that's not terribly useful for cheatgrass. Mm-hmm. There aren't enough goats in the world to be able to deal with it.
On these remote landscapes.
Yeah. But on a small scale, especially in areas where fire is a problem, and cheatgrass is very, very well adapted to fire, that targeted grazing can provide some buffers around development where fire moving in would have serious economic damages. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of effort being thrown at solving invasive species problems, but they're really hard. The amount of effort thrown at them isn't usually proportional to how hard they are. So rangelands are flyover areas.
Right.
They don't have a lot of political power. And mm-hmm. that's where, in our country at least, that's where a lot of the research is driven from.
Absolutely.
Does your senator or congressperson, can they control appropriations?
I want to go back to water. You mentioned mm-hmm. That rangelands play an important role in our water cycle. And what is that role?
Arizona is a really amazing case because we depend a lot on the Colorado River. And the vast majority of the Colorado River's watershed is in rangelands and forests. So at high elevation forests, before it gets down to where the rivers and its various tributaries are, it's in rangeland. And anything that is done to that rangeland can have an effect on what happens to that water. So one of the things we typically see in the Southwest when an environment has had too high a stocking rate of livestock for a long period of time is we'll tend to see water doesn't infiltrate in the soil, so it mm-hmm. runs off more quickly. So when a serious rainstorm happens, we tend to get flooding and cutting of streams, erosion, and we also don't get recharge of groundwater.
Can we pause right there and talk
sure.
about how that actually happens? So how, let's say, you've got a beautifully intact grassland, you've got a riparian area, some water moving through it, cattle are left there. What starts to happen if they're left there for a long time?
So ultimately, part of the effect that any animal will have, any herbivorous or an animal that eats plants will have on that environment is they're going to remove leaf area and stems above the ground. So as they graze, as they consume, in many environments, it will expose bare ground such that when precipitation occurs, and it's kind of easiest to imagine with rain, it doesn't hit a plant first, it hits the ground. And when it does, it picks up soil particles and they move. Animals can also, depending on their weight and depending on the amount of litter, they can compress the soil, which affects infiltration. And sort of the combination of those two things, getting too much defoliation, too much bare ground, too much compression, short-term will lead to problems with infiltration and can lead to problems mm-hmm. with erosion. There's sort of longer-term consequences of herbivory grazing that are different but related. And that involves actually change in the structure of the vegetation. In many areas in the Great Plains and really throughout the Southwest, beginning in the 1870s, really high stocking rates with livestock reduced the amount of grass, increased the amount of bare ground. And what it caused was a reduction in normal fire occurrence. So fires that might have occurred every 3 to 5 years, well, there's no fuel to cause them to spread.
Oh, interesting.
And when that happened, woody plants moved in to these grassland environments. Well, when that happens, you go from a grassland to a woodland or a shrubland. And now we have plants that are roots are very, very deep, and they're taking water from the groundwater. They're changing the hydrology of the whole system. And if you're a rancher in southeastern Arizona, you're still dealing with that. Every rangeland environment in our part of the world has been invaded by shrubs. There's no easy way to go back. It has consequences on a lot of things, but it certainly has consequences for how we manage rangeland environments now. We're very, very far from anything that could even be thought of as pristine.
And actually, I skipped my first question that I wanted to ask you, which was really the overall state of our rangelands today, which you're giving us a real sense of historically. And we're dealing with a vastly different type of landscape than was here, let's say, 250 years ago in terms of grasslands.
Yeah, well, it does depend on where you look. And it also depends on how indigenous people used rangeland environments. In the central and northern Great Plains, a lot more utilization by indigenous people than would have been seen here in the Southwest.
And by utilization, do you mean kind of management, controlled burns, things like that?
Yeah. When I think about rangelands in the United States, there's numbers that I always sort of focus on. 60% of the land is privately owned, and much of that is actually in the northern Great Plains. So that means 40% of it is federally owned, federally managed, rather, or is managed by states. And I think in the continental United States, when we look at our rangelands and think about the condition they're in right now, generally, I would say they're in a state of transition. We managed rangelands beginning in the early decade, first decade or second decade of the last century. And it progressed around about until the 1970s. Sort of open range more or less disappeared in the 1930s. But the period from around 1910 to 1970 was a period where the emphasis was placed primarily on livestock as the primary objective for management, so livestock productivity. And a couple of things happened in the 70s that have changed that, and that's the National Environmental Policy Act, which is usually referred to as NEPA, and the Endangered Species Act. Both of those were in the early 1970s with revisions since then. But what that has meant is that publicly managed rangelands are decreasingly being managed with livestock productivity as a primary objective. Lots more things like threatened and endangered species, just generally sensitive species, riparian value, cultural value, watershed yield, fire. So strictly being managed so that a more natural fire regime can be introduced. That's something that as recently as the 1990s would have been heresy, but it's actually now quite common.
Where do you think we're transitioning to if we continue following these newer management principles?
Well, I think in terms of public rangelands, I think that the transition is going to be away from grazing allotments with livestock on a lot of public land. And there's a wide variety of reasons for that. But the basic issues are driven by NEPA and ESA. Climate change is a major threat to rangeland environments. And in many cases, things like watershed yield in our part of the world are going to take on, or increasingly taking on already, actual economic value. Mm-hmm. So that we could go to someone grazing livestock on a public land allotment and say, for some value, we as a water provider will pay you to remove those livestock so we can, you know, sort of maintain health of the watershed. And increasingly, that sort of opportunity is becoming available on public land. It's also being done in some cases in private lands as well.
We have mentioned all the things that the cascading effects of overgrazing.
Right.
And that we're, you know, we see some overgrazing happening today, and we're also still recovering from tremendous amounts of overgrazing in the past. So basically things get compounded over time. And also at the same time, we've mentioned a few ways that livestock can be used to benefit rangelands and grasslands.
Sure.
And so can you talk to us a little bit about what happens? Let's say tomorrow, all the large ruminants, domestic large ruminants, get removed from public land. I would love to hear what would happen. And my guess would be that short term, 5 to 10 to 20 years, we'd see a real recovery in especially in our riparian areas. We'd see like, oh my gosh, this looks so great. And that long term, we may have some other things happen. What do you think?
That's a really, really challenging question. In the Great Plains, I think that probably the question that I would want to ask is, when we remove the livestock, are we going to allow natural fires to exist?
Because they can serve a similar role.
Yeah. So the evolution of especially ruminant animals and grasslands and the plants within them, grasses are really dealing with defoliation, and that is loss of stems and leaves. An animal may do that. A fire may do that. A drought may do that. Mm-hmm. All three of them. And it turns out plants are really smart because evolution has created them mechanisms growing from the base, essentially pushing old leaves up. And what that means is if we continue to suppress wildfire on grasslands and we take the animals away, we're probably going to see changes in the species composition that we really don't want to see. I think that if we could have livestock grazing in the Great Plains environments that mimics bison grazing, mm-hmm. insofar as we could do that with livestock, that would be wonderful.
Have you seen the collar technology coming out? I'm watching this really closely. So I'd love to just summarize for our audience, sort of correct me where you disagree, but I think of grazing as kind of this Goldilocks thing where it, you know, it's got to be just right. It's got to be at just the right time, just the right amount. And it's sometimes more of an art in some ways than a science of trying to read the landscape and see like, how can animals help? Where do they need to stay away from here? Where do they need to go? And then there's kind of the art of the quantities, the stocking rate.
Right.
And so historically, I've seen estimates from 30 to 60 million bison in North America. Does that sound right to you?
Right. That's about right. Yeah.
And so they would have come through in vast herds that would have probably done what looked like, wow, they really took out a lot of our plants here. They really disturbed this area, but they would have moved quickly through, not come back for a long time. And that disturbance, because plants are smart, like you said, and they strategically are saying, hey, I'm delicious, you know, eat me. There's benefits to this. You're going to spread the seed around. You're going to remove the dead leaves for me. And young leaves are going to get more sunlight. You may even disturb the soil in such a way that kind of lightly allows new seeds to germinate, things like that. That whole ecological system allowed a lot of good topsoil to be built. These things worked hand in hand. And so what we see today is you can have great grazers out there trying to replicate, and that's what we try to do here. At best, we're an imitation of that process. But when you park livestock in the same place for a long time, that Goldilocks thing turns bad pretty quickly as they continually hammer the same plants, exhausting those plants essentially. They don't recover. And then it leaves room for these sort of things like cheatgrass that love disturbed soil to come in. And then this erodes, then the livestock don't even want to eat them. We also have bison and cattle. I like to talk about them as kind of similar in a lot of ways. And yet, because cattle are domesticated, we see them, they're just lazier. They're less flighty. They respond less, you know, to predators, things like that. And so they like to hang out, especially in lush riparian areas, which is why these areas get so hammered and they're so scrutinized in where livestock are concerned. We have this new technology, virtual electric fencing, being tested that would potentially allow ranchers to move cattle completely virtually off, keep them off sensitive areas, and then move them daily to new grass in a way that has not been possible until now without manually herding them. Okay, over to you.
Yeah, there we go. And so there's so many things floating around in there. No pun intended, because we're talking about riparian zones. But so the Kanza Prairie, which is in eastern Kansas, is probably one of the best places where bison have been reintroduced into a natural grassland environment. And I went back and looked at the sort of stocking rates for bison that they had there. And essentially, for a long period of time now, on the Kanza Prairie, it's been about 1/10 of an animal unit per acre for the entire year. Yeah, it works out to be about 11.5 acres per cow. And so if you look at year-round grazing of cattle, it's all over the place, but it's generally going to be about 3/10 to almost 2 animal units per acre year-round. And many of those animals are being fed something in a lot of environments during some period of the time. So the stocking rates with livestock are much, much, much higher. Mm-hmm. Another thing to know about bison is that they will preferentially consume grass. The broadleaf, other plants in there, be they woody or not, that cattle will consume along with grass. Bison just don't tend to do that. And what that actually does is explains part of the reason why there's more biological diversity present with bison, because they tend to focus on that primary grass forage plant that's in the environment. There's a lot of interest, especially among indigenous Americans, in using bison as livestock, basically. Mm-hmm. I would only say that we need to be careful in that we don't think of bison and cattle as being interchangeable. They're mm-hmm. really very, very different. Although the consequences on the vegetation can be kind of grossly similar. Many bison populations have been crossed with cattle, and so they actually do carry some cattle genes.
Interesting.
And that's an issue now for all raisers of bison, indigenous or otherwise, in that is it true bison or is it bison that have a little bit of cattle?
A beefalo. I guess I've heard that term.
Yeah, certainly. Huh. That was 30 and 40 years ago when bison were just beginning to be sort of semi-domesticated. That was a big product. Now, virtual fencing. I have some exposure because a fairly big project is going on 40 miles south of me here at the Santa Rita Experimental Range, sort of road testing virtual fencing technology. But the idea is a mother cow, at least some fraction of the cows within a herd, will have a transmitter that is connected either to a satellite signal or a cellular signal. And essentially the boundaries are drawn on a digital map. And as she walks inside, wherever those boundaries have been drawn, as she gets close to them, she hears a sound. And as she gets to the line, she gets a warning. It's usually a shock. And the idea is that the animals can be moved and restrained using this technology. I'm not part of that research, but I know one of the people who's doing it, and I've talked a lot with him. It's an emerging technology. Mm-hmm. I'm speaking euphemistically and saying it has a lot of problems in our environment, which is topographically really rough and also has a lot of shrubs and other things that these collars can get hung up on. one of the big challenges they had was actually finding collars that no longer had cows attached. But even saying that, he told me, and from what I have followed in the field, this is truly a technology that is going to revolutionize grazing and grazing management in many parts of the world. It already is having significant effects in Western Europe. And it's going to, I think, make it possible to do things with a type of grazing, short duration, high intensity is how we would refer to it, that has a lot of advantages. You know, you give the animals a day under very, very competitive circumstances. They don't have the opportunity to be choosy in what they consume. And after that day, they go away.
And they don't come back for maybe the whole year, maybe longer on some of these really sensitive, really sensitive zones.
That's right.
So I'm sort of, my bias is that I'm pretty passionate to see how, like, these things are cool. Like, if you can use them in a certain way, what they can do is sort of miraculous, especially sheep and goats, in my opinion, because they're not so picky. They're kind of browsers. And so they love a lot of these invasives, and they will eat cheatgrass more readily. They love thistle, all kinds of things that can tend to dominate. There's a theory that grasslands and ruminants, grazers kind of co-evolved. And to me, to my brain, that makes a lot of sense. Can you speak to that? And how, you know, if you don't think they co-evolved, you know, how do they work together in an ideal world when everything's going well?
No, they absolutely did co-evolve. And it's amazing when I look at grasses, native grasses that are particularly well adapted here in the Southwest, I'm humbled by them. I mean, I really am. This is evolution that is doing some really, really amazing things to allow these plants to tolerate defoliation. So there's no question that the animals and plants, especially grasses, have co-evolved together.
Okay.
One of the things that is occasionally seen is a phenomenon called overcompensation. And essentially what it is a plant, a grass actually, that is defoliated usually by an animal will over time grow more than is one that is not defoliated. And sometimes it has to do with light penetration, but other times it doesn't seem to be that way. It's important to realize when we talk about that little evolutionary alternative that some people have looked for it, have never found it. Other people look for it and find it all the time. And still other people find it sometimes and don't find it other times. It's funny, when I talk about grazing, either with grazers, with livestock producers, or frankly, more frequently, I talk with students here about grazing, I've come to the conclusion that it's the hardest thing to do in agriculture correctly. I started out as a crop scientist and as a plant breeder, actually. I've transitioned into wildland plants and how we manage them. And the things that agriculturalists, that crop producers do, nothing is as complicated as grazing management.
So humbling. I'm so glad I didn't know how hard it was going to be before I started.
That's right. You know, going back to virtual fencing, we haven't seen this really explosive increase in utility and effectiveness, but I think we will. And it'll be pretty soon that it'll get cheap. It's not real cheap right now. It'll get cheap.
Well, something that this brings to mind for me is we have been domesticating cattle on certain criteria, essentially like will their offspring gain quickly in a feedlot on corn and soy and different grains. I would love to see over time us to start breeding for different criteria. And that is already sort of happening. You can buy like high country bulls. You know, there are... There are whole herds of cattle that are adapted to grazing in the high country, and ones, you know, if they don't come from that kind of landscape and you buy a bunch of those cows and you bring them up to 5,500 feet and say, graze this hillside, they're going to say, yeah, right. I'm going to sit down here on this creek bed and trash it. And you can, there's variation, you know, among the cattle. So I think, you know, as we start to see these new technologies, maybe we start to have different breeding criteria, and also criteria as, can you convert feed more efficiently on native grasses?
Oh, yeah. Well, then there's quite a bit of interest in the Southwest in using Spanish breeds. There's one that has a variety of common names. It's often called a criollo. And it's a looks sort of like a skinny longhorn.
That's redundant. It's even skinnier.
yes, even skinnier and smaller. And there's a couple of ranches actually just south and east of Tucson here where they've basically built their herds using genetic resources, I believe directly from Spain, over 20, 30 years. And it's also a direct consumer to market operation. Mm-hmm. So he's developed relationships with consumers and doesn't put his beef out into the traditional markets. But yeah, they're really, really successful, much more successful than traditional English breeds or even hybrid English breeds are here. And a lot of it has to do with how they browse more rather than graze and also how they use water.
And I also sort of joke, but it's true, like herds have cultures to me. Mm-hmm. And so I will kind of call with the sense of like, is this you fitting in, you know, with what we're trying to do here? When I first got into sheep, they were very choosy. They were very picky. They wouldn't eat a lot of the stems. They wanted leaf. And through kind of this culture of like, you don't move until you eat your stems, they're much more aggressive and competitive with each other in terms of grazing. And they're doing a better job kind of clearing areas that we want cleared. And
it's interesting you say that because as it turns out, the virtual fencing project, they're culling cows that can't be taught.
Right. Yes.
To sort of respond.
You want that sensitivity.
Right.
I would love to pivot to, you mentioned your background as a plant breeder and you and I had talked previously. I have this axe to grind with sort of the term grass finished, grain finished. When I got into ranching, I came into it very naive. I was here to be save the ranchers to ranch so well and nobody else was doing it right because I'd seen all the documentaries and I came into it and I learned all these staggering things that I had no idea. And one of them was barley, wheat, oats, and corn are all grasses.
Yeah.
And my axe to grind today is that that's very confusing because we think of them in a very separate category as grasses. And so I want to paint a picture for the audience so that they can kind of, I can tee up the question I'm going to ask you, which is basically we run a grass-fed sheep herd. And in the fall, some of the pastures they're encountering have grasses in them that have seed heads on them. They're going to seed. They're eating that seed head and the leaves and the stem as part of their grazing. Now, that is considered grass-fed. However, a different grass species, when you essentially, and correct me if I'm wrong, but if that barley grass is standing in a field, in a pasture, they can also eat that grain, the seed head, and it's considered grass-fed. The minute you remove the grain and you feed it to them essentially in isolation kind of in a different ratio, that becomes no longer grass-fed. That's grain finished.
Yeah.
And my question to you is like, help understand these terms.
Also,
what makes these cereal grasses, like, are they fundamentally different? How are they different?
Yeah, I mean, we could start with that in that the grass family is huge and has, you know, thousands and thousands of species in it. And relatively few of them have been modified by humans in the ways that our typical cereal grains have been, to have these very, very large grains, which is actually a fruit that has a little seed inside, that are packed with carbohydrates.
Sorry, so, it's actually a fruit?
Yeah, botanically, it's formed by the ovary. And the ovary, whatever is there and inside, would be a fruit.
Okay.
And a grain, it's also known as a caryopsis. It's a fruit. And there's a small part of it is actually the seed sitting inside, just one seed per fruit. But, you know, maybe 40 of those grass species we've modified so to create these monstrously large carbohydrate dense energy storehouses, because that's really what they are, that get called cereal grains. And when we start to talk about what animals are consuming, it's, you know, recently, as you've described, mostly in the last 20 to 30 years, we've wanted to try to describe a different sort of production system by describing what the animals mostly consume.
Yes.
And the easy term to sort of fall back on was grass-fed, unfortunately. And if you poke around a little bit on the web and you read laterally, so you sort of make sure you check out who it is that's saying what they're saying, it's hard to find a generally accepted definition of what it truly means. The U.S. Department of Agriculture actually used to have one, but they've now backed away from it. And certain parts of the USDA, certain special programs actually do. So I found that there's a USDA grass-fed small and very small producer program. And it's actually a certification that they provide. They have an explicit definition. I won't read it, but I'll explain basically what it is. And that is, once an animal is weaned, for their entire life, they will consume grasses that are not flowering or have produced grains.
Wow. So really not mature
that's
grasses.
Right. It turns out cereal grain crops. So anything that would be classified as a cereal grain crop, bromgrass wouldn't, barley would, sorghum would, corn would, wheat would. And okay, that's fine. I actually think a simpler approach, maybe it's not simpler, and only you could tell me whether I'm way off base here, is simply to explain how the animals have been treated.
Right.
What have they eaten? You know, let's not try to use this easy to state term that may mean absolutely nothing.
Because you can be grass fed and finished in a feedlot, for example.
Right.
And customers are hearing the term grass fed and they're making all kinds of extrapolations based on that. And I'll tell you how we finish our beef and sort of my case for it. So we were up in this northern climate. And so what we do to have basically a more consistent supply of beef year round is we do a light barley finish. So our animals are eating about 80, 90% grass. And then we're supplementing with barley that my husband grows himself.
Right.
And that is, like we mentioned, also a grass, but it's also a cereal grain.
Right.
And one of my sort of arguments is like, because it's such a light ration in compared to what they might receive at a feedlot, it's not really that dissimilar to what the ratio of, let's say, like, you know, seeds to stems or leaves that they would have, like, normally, you know, in the fall, let's say, if they were just wild and we were in an intact landscape. So I sort of try to paint this picture for our customers that for us, economically, 100% grass-fed cattle can be tough. You can be looking at 3 years to finish a steer. And you can also be looking at maybe a taste or a texture that not every customer prefers. And I kind of am like, it's hard enough out here, you guys. So we do this modified approach that I try to give, you know, I think it gives us a kind of the best of both worlds. But explaining all that, like I just did to you, is like many minutes and it's kind of tedious and it doesn't fit easily on a marketing brochure.
Right. And obviously, so a lot of people just default to grass-fed. I mean, when I talk with beef producers, and I typically talk with them actually at farmers markets, because that's where in this city, you know, I live in a city of 500,000 people. That's the easiest access point. It's a matter of them being able to explain kind of in that detail. And I'm pretty sure that they will adjust that depending on the questions that the consumer or potential consumer is asking.
I want to pivot again.
Good.
And we don't have to get into this deeply, but something I think about a lot is monocultures. I think, you know, for all the criticisms there are, and many of them so valid against livestock, I don't see like, okay, we get rid of all the cows, you know, let's do some more intensive farming. I'm like ecologically just never really sure. In fact, I'm actually pretty sure that's not necessarily a better move. I'm like, let's just manage better. Like, can we address the issues with management rather than sort of getting rid of all the livestock. Where I'm trying to go with this is GMOs, your opinion on GMO crops. And my concern with them is, well, number one, I hate that any type of food is intellectual property. I hate it. And number two, my understanding is that they are essentially genetically identical individuals. Like every, you know, corn plant is going to be genetically identical, which is going to give you yield benefits. But it makes me concerned in terms of food, like vulnerability.
Yeah.
What do you think?
You know, humans have been genetically modifying plants and animals for probably around 11, 12,000 years. Mm-hmm. And when we talk about GMOs now, we're talking about really specific changes that are associated with usually bringing genes from some other source, some other organism, or modifying genes in a very deliberate way, very different from what farmers or plant and animal breeders have done over most of that, you know, 12,000 years.
How is the process different?
Well, in many respects, it's different only because we're taking a gene or a group of genes. We know what they are. We know what they're going to do, like provide resistance to a herbicide. It's a really, really simple little insertion, essentially, into the crop, or actually into the animal, because it's happening there too.
Yeah, it's salmon.
Right, sure. That's the best known example there. And when we think about traditional animal and plant breeding, we're really talking less about changing individual genes in that way, but we're talking about sculpting an entire series of genes that are expressed in that organism and the job that they do. Mm-hmm. So it's a much more holistic thing. It's much less deterministic, where producing GMOs, as we refer to them now, is very deterministic. Interestingly, 10 years ago, I would have been much more concerned about things like genetic diversity becoming a problem. I'm less concerned now. Part of what we have to realize when we think about genetic diversity in both plants and animals is that in many cases in nature, there are very strict rules. So if you walk into a wheat field today or a barley field today, or if you walked into those fields 100 years ago or 200 years ago, every plant in that field would be genetically the same. That's a function of how that plant reproduces. It self-pollinates, and individual heads are almost always saved. So that field is derived from one single individual head that is completely true breeding. Mm-hmm. So no genetic variation within a field. Hybrids, like most of the corn that is grown in North America, is an F1 hybrid, which means two particular parents were crossed with each other. And again, in every field, every one of those individual plants since the 1940s, basically, is exactly the same. There's no genetic variation there. Now, you can also find corn growing all over in North America that is more like what corn originally was 4,000 years ago when it was created. It wasn't really domesticated. It was created by people in Mexico. And there will be genetic diversity within.
It sounds like the lack of genetic diversity, first of all, you're saying it's not new. Second of all, it doesn't concern you too much. Can you?
No, you know, in the 1970s in the United States, we went through a real big problem with corn, actually, where essentially a very large proportion of the corn grown in the United States, they were all F1 hybrids, but they all shared this single susceptibility to a disease. And it was called southern corn leaf blight. And basically every corn population had it. Every corn hybrid had it. And the loss in that one year was really, really profound. It caused a real awakening among a lot of plant breeders to say, hey, wait a minute, we've really, truly got to get serious about diversity so that we don't have this problem. So it really started then. the appearance of GMOs hasn't really changed it that much. Proprietariness in crops began really in the 1960s when state universities like the one that I work for started to make decisions saying, we're not going to do plant breeding with public good as a primary interest. We're going to let companies do that. That started in the 60s and really took off in the 80s.
When you say public good, you mean resilience to things like blight, different diseases?
Sure. I mean, ultimately, what corn breeders say in Iowa were doing is they were providing materials that could either be directly used by the farmers in Iowa, or they would provide those materials also to seed companies. The public is in the U.S. has pretty much gotten out of that business in Western Europe and Australia. It's become privatized. And that is where proprietary support essentially comes from. These companies aren't going to invest if they can't be assured that their investment can be protected. And it can be done in a variety of ways. The thing that exacerbates it is that GMO production is more expensive still. It's really, really, really expensive. And so they're even more inclined to want to force growers to toe the line, which may mean you can't replant your own seed or you've got to use our chemical to treat the plants derived from our seed.
Or yeah, a lot of times it's not legal. You don't own
the seed. That's right.
And these GMOs are, I mean, as much as they make me nervous in terms of resilience, and I always think of some kind of super blight coming out of nowhere and just hitting a vulnerability. And I just always go back to, I feel like it's a rule of nature that diversity is strength.
The thing, though, that I would urge everybody to think about and learn about is that people who are generating these products, GMO or otherwise, they know that. And having resilience built in is something that can easily be sold. And so they think about it. They think about it a lot.
And to speak sort of the other side of the coin is, my criticisms aside, like, GMOs can be a sustainability tool in terms of consuming less water, being more drought resilient, things like that.
Yeah, and, it's interesting. I'll put my plant breeder hat on here.
Say,
I remember the 1980s when GMO sort of became a term, and where geneticists started to think about using these tools to do plant and animal improvement. And there were a lot of claims made about how this would revolutionize agriculture. Many of those claims are still being made 40 years later. The number of true successes is relatively small now.
Wait, okay, correct me. My understanding is, like, we had the Green Revolution and Norman Borlaug, and we fixed the wheat problem, and he saved 7 billion lives. Like,
and that was all plant breeding. And that was all plant breeding.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was all plant breeding.
Okay. Yeah.
So I'm talking.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm talking about the sort of mid 1980s genetically modified organism application, which is using DNA modification that's really deliberate.
Oh,
that's what I'm talking about.
Are you saying that the claims are a bit overblown?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Okay, and have been.
Absolutely. And
so this sense of, like, we have to have GMOs because this are going to be this amazing climate change tool. You're kind of like, not so much.
No, I think, though, having said that, there is a tool that soon will have effects on plant and animals that we use in agriculture, that the organisms resulting from use of this tool will probably still be called GMOs, but it is fundamentally different, and it's called CRISPR.
Okay.
And this is a genetic editing technology where, not having to insert or turn off, but we can literally go in and make those very deterministic changes. And there's already, in both animals and plants, quite a number of pretty significant things that have been done there. And I think that, as a plant scientist, the biggest thing that GMO technology has given us is a lot of knowledge about how these organisms function. With that knowledge, when a tool like CRISPR has now become available, some truly revolutionary things could happen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mid-1980s to mid-2020s GMO technology, no, probably not so much.
Okay.
But 2030s, CRISPR is going to change a lot of things.
And could probably, potentially, we could be growing crops that are less resource demanding, for example.
Maybe. I mean, that's a big ask. Yeah, but I think what we're going to be looking at is changes that are a little bit more substantial than, resistance to a herbicide, which is pretty provincial, frankly, when you think about it. That's like, okay, give me the easiest thing you could possibly do. Oh, you've done that.
Okay.
What else can you do? And there hasn't been an awful lot beyond that. Simple single gene changes in proteins. Yeah, we can do that. But CRISPR could conceivably go after really complex traits like how plants respond and animals respond to their environment, which are really complicated. Dealing with drought, dealing with heat, dealing with cold, those are complicated, complicated traits. And CRISPR has the potential to really make a difference there.
Steve, thank you so much for giving me so much of your time.
Absolutely.
I feel like I could talk to you for a long time. Very, very grateful. And is there anything you would like to leave the audience with?
Whenever I get a chance to talk to people about what I do and what I think about, probably the first thing I do is I thank them, because honestly, I've never had to really work since I was in college. Because I have the greatest job in the world where I just get to focus on knowledge and help people to learn.
Mm-hmm.
So I would hope that anything that we may have talked about will cause people to think about themselves in the environment and then that they'll go and learn more, and that as they learn more, they'll pass that on to other people, that they'll support people and organizations that are doing good things.
Mm-hmm.
And probably importantly, unfortunately, vote for politicians that are saying at least that they'll do the right thing.
Right. At least say it. At least giving it lip service. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So I love talking about this. I think I'm probably in the 7th or 8th circle of environmental activists. Well, I listened to that yesterday. And I'm thinking, I'm probably 7 or 8. Maybe
that's, I mean, I feel like anyone with a PhD, you skip right to 8. Like,
No. I know a lot of people who are good 4s and 5s right
now.
Oh
my gosh. 4s and 5. Yeah. It's the ego trap of being in a 4. That's where I started. And I always joke, that's where like everyone comes into regenerative ranching as a 4.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely.
So humbling.
Yeah.
Anyway, thank you so much for coming on. So grateful for your time, and thank you for the work that you do. Thank you for joining me today on Choose Wisely. I hope your next meal is delicious and your next conversation nuanced. Thank you again to Professor Steve Smith for joining me today on the episode. Choose Wisely is produced by me and edited by Lauren DeLuca. Please take a minute and rate and review the podcast. We really appreciate it. And take a minute to follow us along on socials. We are on Instagram at ChooseWiselyPodcast. You can drop us a line by email at choosewiselypodcast@gmail.com. And you can become a regenerator at patreon.com/choosewiselypodcast and find the links in the show notes. Bye.